Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you. And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. This is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of the Honorable Booker T. Washington, the author of the book Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. We'd like to share some of our book with you this evening. In order to fully understand and appreciate the Black Revolutionary philosophy of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, it is necessary to review the degree of spiritual impoverishment that had come with the African American slaves' relegation to the status of nearly inhuman chattel property. This spiritual impoverishment was the product of the cruelty and hopelessness that was endured by the black slaves, along with the wretched physical circumstances of their lives. The great abolitionist Frederick Douglass noted that, quote, the men and the women slaves on his slave master, Colonel Lloyd's farm, received as their monthly allowance of food 8 pounds of pickled pork, or its equivalent in fish. The pork was often tainted, spoiled, and wormy, and the fish were of the poorest quality. With their meat or fish, they had given them one bushel of Indian meal, unbolted, of which quite 15% was more fit for pigs than for men. With this, 1 pint of salt was given, 1 pint of salt. And this was the entire monthly allowance of a full-grown slave working constantly in the open field from morning till night every day in the month except Sunday. There is no kind of work which really requires a better supply of food to prevent physical exhaustion than the field work of a slave. The yearly allowance of clothing was not more ample than the supply of food. It consisted of 2-toe linen shirts, like burlap bag material, and 1 pair of trousers of the same coarse material for summer, and a pair of trousers and a woolen pair of trousers and a woolen jacket for winter, with 1 pair of yarn stockings and a pair of the coarsest description. Children under 10 years old had neither shoes, stockings, jackets, nor trousers. They had 2 coarse towel linen, like burlap bag material, shirts, and when these were worn out, they went naked till the next allowance day. And this was the condition of the little girls as well as the boys. As to beds, they had none. 1 coarse blanket was given to them, and this only to the men and women. The children stuck themselves in holes and corners about the quarters, and often in the corners of huge chimneys, and put their feet in the ashes to keep them warm. Unquote. That's from Frederick Douglass' memoirs. When ambitious 25-year-old Booker T. Washington arrived in Macon County, Alabama, in the spring of 1881, he was fresh from a teaching position at Coastal Virginia's Hampton Institute. He had prepared himself to come to Alabama to teach. However, he knew absolutely nothing about the depths to which the former slaves had been degraded by their white masters. Little did he expect to be the black revolutionary that God had sent them, to completely change or revolutionize their lives. In his signature work, Up From Slavery, Booker T. Washington candidly confesses, what I saw during my month of travel and investigation upon his arrival in Tuskegee, Alabama, in the spring of 1881, left me with a very heavy heart. The work to be done in order to lift these people up seemed almost beyond accomplishing. Of one thing, I felt more strongly convinced than ever after spending this month in seeing the actual life of the colored people, and that was that in order to lift them up, something must be done more than merely to imitate New England education as it then existed. Unquote. It is interesting to note at this point that here is a young man quite new to the dangers inherent in being a black man in the hostile Deep South who has one single focus in his mind, that is, to revolutionize, to change completely the impoverished and degraded lives of his fellow African Americans. Unlike later black revolutionaries who sought to bring about these changes through political agitation or threats of mob violence, as in the Watts riots that occurred 50 years after his death, Booker T. Washington was determined to use industriousness, education, and community development or nation building as the vehicle to lift the ex-slaves up as human beings and citizens of the United States of America. As stated, however, the type of education that he proposed was not the kind that was used to educate the already settled European Americans. Dr. Washington knew that teaching sharecroppers and tenant farmers how to read and write Greek and Latin or recite the romantic poetry of Wordsworth, Keats, Byron, and Shelley was not the most advantageous road to economic and cultural advancement for the newly emancipated slaves. Another black revolutionary, Professor W.E.B. Du Bois, a product of a New England Harvard education, opposed Booker T. Washington's method of uplifting the recently emancipated African Americans who lived in the Deep South. Although he had lived in urban Nashville, Tennessee, and Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Du Bois' appreciation for the day-to-day struggles of black and brown people lacked the depth of understanding that growing up on a Virginia slave plantation had given Booker T. Washington in his early life. Dr. Du Bois admitted that the prudent method of bringing about the cooperation of the European Americans in uplifting the African Americans was to weld the former slaves to the future industries of the South. Although he praised the accomplishments of the common schools and the trade schools, such as the Tuskegee Institute, headed by Booker T. Washington, Professor Du Bois firmly believed that it was the classical college education that would be the best vehicle to advance the masses of African Americans through the agency of the talented 10th. A few specially selected college-trained African Americans. W.E.B. Du Bois's thinking was that, quote, within the minds of African Americans there must come a loftier respect for the human soul that seeks to know itself and the world around it, that seeks a freedom for self-expansion and self-development. In achieving this ambitious goal of uplifting our people intellectually and culturally, W.E.B. Du Bois called upon classical intellectuals such as Aristotle, Balzac, Dumas, Aristotle, and Aurelius as beacons for African-American enlightenment. As a product of an excellent classical education myself from the University of California at Berkeley, Tuskegee University, Norwich University, Denver University, Augusta University, Northwest Missouri State University, and Alabama A&M Universities, I totally concur with Dr. Du Bois concerning the value of such learning and intellectual development. At the same time, however, I also concur with another black revolutionary, the Honorable Elijah X. Poole Muhammad. Messenger Muhammad, as he was respectfully called, advocated that African Americans or black people should get an education which will benefit their own people, and not an education adding to the storehouse of their teacher. We need education, he said, but an education which removes us from the shackles of slavery and servitude. Get an education, but not an education which leaves us in an inferior position and without a future. Get an education, but not an education that leaves us looking to the slave masters for a job, unquote. The founder of what has become nationally celebrated Black History Month, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, declared in his blistering critique the miseducation of the Negro that highly educated Negroes who advocate for a sort of education different only in some respects from that now given the white man, Negroes who have been so long inconvenienced and denied opportunities for development are naturally afraid of anything that sounds like discrimination. They are anxious to have everything the white man has, even if it is harmful. The so-called modern education, with all its defects, however, does others so much more good than it does the Negro, because it has been worked out in conformity to the needs of those who have enslaved and oppressed weaker people. In the book Education in Alabama, Dr. Horace Mann Bond observed that the ongoing agenda of the Negro's former slave masters was clearly stated by post-emancipation white leaders, who said, quote, the Negro is considered hopelessly helpless by his want of self-reliance, by his want of experience, and his want of the ability to understand and appreciate his situation. And the former slave owners believed that the white man must secure the services of the Negroes and teach them their place, and convince African Americans that their best friends were the people who had raped, robbed, enslaved, and dehumanized them for 300 years without mercy or compassion. Within a writing 75 years after the end of slavery, Dr. Horace Mann Bond protested, quote, it is clear that the former slave owners never intended to accept the freedom of Negroes without the reservation that members of the race should continue to be wards and under the tutelage of the class which had owned them before the war. Thus, the concept envisioned by Booker T. Washington that African Americans should be educated to come into their own, independent of the inferiority conferring miseducation of their former slave masters, was truly revolutionary. And a quote from the Holy Bible from Nehemiah chapter 1 verse 10, now these are thy servants and thy people whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. And that is the end of the chapter, the end of the chapter, which is entitled The Introduction to the Book. And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to Area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006.
Good evening, everyone. Those of you who are listening via the internet, we want to welcome you again to our show for tonight. If you were on earlier listening, we're going to talk some more about the same topic. We had a brief interlude, but we're going to return to that topic. I want to take this opportunity to welcome my dear sister-in-law, Stephanie Benson Runnels. I'm so glad that you were able to make it tonight. And how are you doing
this evening? Thank you. I'm good.
Okay. Good. Okay. Well, great. Well, actually, right now, it's just you and myself, and hopefully others may join us. We do have some who normally listen just via the internet, and so I'm going to repeat the phone number in case they want to call in and join in the conversation. We've got about another hour almost to go. And so if anyone's listening and you want to call in and comment, the number is 657-383-0671. And the topic that we actually had started talking about earlier was the question, at what point should universities stop on campus, in class, instruction, and basically do like many universities did in the spring, close down the campuses, send the students back home to be able to control or to diminish the spread of the coronavirus. You know, is there some point where now that school has started back for the fall, many campuses have opened up fully, where the students are back in the classroom? I know at my school that's the case. At what point should they close down again? The reason why I chose this topic is because it is reported today that the University of Alabama, their flagship campus is in Tuscaloosa, Florida, that they have, since school started, they have reported 1,200 students have been tested positive with the coronavirus just since the beginning of school, which was a couple, 3 weeks ago. And the administration is saying, and I don't have any way to verify this, but they're saying that they're tracing what they call contact tracing methods have indicated that this coronavirus that resulted in 1,200 positive cases has not been spread by the in-classroom instruction, because they have the desk space apart, you know, where there's the 6 feet social distancing, and they're requiring the students to wear a mask in the classroom. What they're saying is that the way the students are contracting the virus is outside of class, maybe bunching up in the hallways waiting to go into the classroom, or in the cafeteria where they take the mask off to eat, and they're sitting around, you know, together in the cafeteria, or even after school, visiting each other's homes, apartments, dormitory rooms, and really having these parties that they have at these big colleges, in the fraternity and sorority houses, block parties they have, you know, in the residential areas, and so forth. They are Many of them are not wearing masks. They certainly aren't social distancing at all. And so this is where the school administration feels that the coronavirus spread is coming from. But still, regardless of how it's happening, when you have 1,200 students on any campus walking around interfacing with each other, you're putting the professors at risk, you're putting the staff at risk, and you're putting other students at risk. Now, the thing is that the University of Alabama said that none of these students that tested positive out of these 1,200 students, none of them have been sick enough to have to go to the hospital. Well, let me just say something about this, and then we'll turn it over to you, Stephanie. The coronavirus does not have any medical treatment yet. In other words, going to the hospital, there's no medicine that they can inject into your body that's going to relieve you of the virus or really relieve you of the symptoms of the virus. And maybe they might be able to bring your temperature down, but it's not going to, they don't have any medicine to heal your lungs once the virus attacks your lungs. So what they're saying is that they don't want to put you in the hospital just because you don't feel good or just because that you're having a dry cough. If you're having severe breathing problems, that's when they want to put you in there. But what they will do is they will monitor that. If the breathing problems don't clear up within a short period of time, then they will intubate you and put you on a ventilator so the machine will do your breathing for you. Now, when that happens, the chances of you coming out of the hospital alive are probably about 50-50 from what I understand. So the people who would be going to the hospital of this student population are people that are in danger of dying. Well, statistically, this population of 17 to 24-year-old students, which is your traditional age that's on campus in college, they're not having such great difficulty with the coronavirus as a general rule where they are close to dying. There's another group that's having this problem, not just college kids. And maybe that's the reason, as I close my little commentary, Stephanie, maybe that's the reason why they're not really taking it seriously, because they may be saying, well, if I get sick, you know, I've had the flu before, I'm going to feel bad maybe for a few days, maybe for a couple of weeks, but I'm going to be fine after that, and I'll get over it. And so I don't want to sacrifice my social life. I don't want to sacrifice hanging out with my friends just to avoid the risk of getting this, because it's not going to be deathly for me. And it may not be so bad where I can't even do what I like to do. Maybe if I don't tell anybody that I'm infected, I can even go to school and not miss any classes. So I think that's really the big issue that needs to be confronted. Is the school going to take any stand? Say if the numbers up at the University of Alabama down there, if it gets to be like 5,000 in the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure how many students are on their campus, but I would imagine it's over 20,000 students, because most of these big state universities have anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 students nowadays on campus. So if 25% of the students are tested positive, will they continue to let the numbers rise by having the students on campus, or will they do like they did in the spring and say, look, y'all need to get away from here, go home, go somewhere else, because we don't want to be responsible for this being a nest or a hotbed of the virus infection. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say on that. What do you think, Stephanie?
Hi, thank you for having me once again on the show. It sounds a lot like playing Russian roulette. I mean, whether the gun is up to your own head or aimed at someone else, it's plain Russian roulette. And everybody knows eventually some tragedy happens in plain Russian roulette. I don't think people should be in school as long as that virus is active and we don't have a cure for it. Schooling needs to be done at home. And I know one thing that students were complaining about when they did have to do the schooling at home, why are they paying this big tuition? You know, but they need to know the school has to keep going. But until we can get some sort of definite cure, we don't need to keep playing Russian roulette with this virus, you know, because it's evidently transferred from person to person. So I hope you're keeping your distance, and other people, well, these young people, you can't tell them nothing. God, you can't tell them nothing because they know it all. You know, and then our president, he's the one kept telling them they don't need a mask, even though all the medical professionals were letting them know that's the least we can do for, to protect ourselves. Wear a mask, keep your hands washed, and wipe everything down. And stay out of the crowds, you know, keep distance from people. And it doesn't look like that's possible, you know, with school settings and so forth. I'm so sorry. My opinion, I don't think schools should only be open for the staff to come there and do what they have to do. But I think it should be online schooling. I know the education is important, but online schooling is what we need to be doing right now. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, it's just us right now, except that we do have those who are just, and I don't mean to say it like that, just listening, because it's important that we do have an audience that is listening via the internet. And I want to invite you all who are listening via the internet, if you want to share in this conversation, please call. The number is 657-383-0671. Again, 657-383-0671. Well, I'll give you my feedback on that. I have actually been back on campus now since the 3rd of August, so it's been almost a month that I've been back on campus. See, classes resumed a week after I got back. They had the faculty come back on campus full time to get ready for the students a week before the students arrived, and the students came back on the 10th, and this is the 29th, so, you know, it's almost been 3 weeks. That as of Monday, it will be 3 weeks exactly that the students have been back on the campus. And I don't get around to the main academic buildings. My office is in the building that also houses the student union, which has the cafeteria. And what the school has done is they have taken out a lot of the tables in the cafeteria, and they have it set up, you know, so that only one person, yeah, can sit at a table, and they got the table spread out for social distance purposes in the cafeteria. And in the cafeteria line, they have these markings on the floor so that people, as they're waiting to go up to get their food from the various places, they've got like four or five, I'll say four places in the food court where you can get, you know, different kinds of food. And they have it where you have to be spread out. But here's the thing. When you leave out of the cafeteria, there's this big hallway, and they have tables out there, and they do have more than one chair at those tables. So two or three students can sit together the way they always have done in the past. And I've seen this with my own eyes, and be eating all close up on each other. And, of course, with the mask off since they're eating. So, You know, it's kind of like, in my opinion, it's ironic that the cafeteria is using the social distancing, but out there in that hallway, they call it the atrium, there's not, but there's no policeman. You know, the manager of the cafeteria, in conjunction with the school officials, decided to take out those extra tables, but they didn't take out the extra chairs out there in that passageway. So the students, what they would have been doing in the cafeteria, they're just taking the food if they got two or three or another person that they want to share lunch with, that they want to have lunch with, they just go out there in the passageway and do what they want to do. So it seems like it's defeating the purpose of taking out all those chairs when the students still are bunching together to be able to socialize what's going on. The other thing is that more and more, and I don't get out to the classroom buildings, but in the building where I am, more and more I see students not wearing their masks. Now, there's no enforcement, even though they have signs up saying that masks or face covering must be worn inside the buildings on the campus. There's no mask police going around telling students you need to put your mask on. You know, so the students are deciding, well, they say that we need to have our mask on, but there's nobody going to make me do it, so I'll just take the mask. And that's, I'm seeing more and more of that happening.
They don't,
like you said a minute ago, you can't tell them anything. They're not taking this seriously at all because they don't know any young people, I guess. You know, young other college students or young high school students or friends of theirs in their age group that have gotten sick and died from it. So they don't feel that it's that big of a deal. And I will say this, you know, president is encouraging that kind of behavior. Him having 1,500 people sitting, you know, 2 inches apart from each other, shoulder to shoulder, on the White House lawn the other night with no mask. Very few people had masks on. I didn't actually see anybody with a mask on. That's sending a signal. Don't worry about getting the virus. It's no big deal. Don't worry about it. Even though one of his top supporters, Herman Cain, went to his the rally that he had in Oklahoma last summer, this past few months, and got sick and died. But it's like, forget about that. It's going to happen. Don't worry about it. It's not that big of a deal. If we lose one or two soldiers along the way, you know, the Army's going to march forward maskless and without socially distance because it's going to be all right. We're going to be fine. And even though the numbers are over 170,000 people that have died, in his mind, that's okay. We're still fine. We're still okay, you know, and forget about wearing the mask. And so he's back on the campaign trail. You know, he loves the crowds. He loves to be applauded by his base. And so campaigning out in these crowded situations. And I guess what we're going to see from now until November is more instant replays of what we saw the last few days at the convention of people packed all together without wearing masks, even though they know that some people got sick from Oklahoma and at least one person that we know of died. But he's going to just say, y'all come on in here, and get sick, take the risk. Don't worry about it. You may die, you may not die, but come on and see me so I can feel good. And he's, unfortunately, he's got a crowd of people, witness those 1,500, that's willing to do that for him. I don't know what, Jackie always talks about some kind of pixie dust that he spread over these people. I don't know what he's got going on, but he's got some of these people, you know, under some magic kind of spell. I know that.
Well, we also know that there was big crowds of people who followed behind Hitler there was big crowds of people who followed Jim Jones all the way to their death, listened to everything he said, like it was spoken Bible itself. And even Charles Manson had followers. So, of course, Donald Trump does have followers, no matter what comes out of his mouth. But I also watched that inauguration speech or whatever it was the day before yesterday, and he wasn't wearing a mask. I saw one or two people wearing a mask out of over 1,000 people, and they were shoulder to shoulder touching. So some people just don't believe fat meat is greasy, you know, and say, you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. So all we can do is continue making sure that we stay safe, praying for people too. I wish they would open their eyes, because a lot of people are going around with their eyes wide shut, and it's very dangerous. You know, the president wanted to sue the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, because the scientists are not, he wants them to get some guinea pigs together now. He wants human experiment on what they're working on. He doesn't want them to wait and see is it safe or nothing. And they won't do it yet. It's not ready even for experimentation. But he wants to sue them because he wants it out there right now. You know, and I'm sure, just like I said, a lot of people with their eyes wide shut, there's going to be a lot of people who will try it if they put it out there via the president. And that's sad, really sad. Yeah, so it's already a whole new world order. You know, things have really changed under Trump's administration, completely, 360-degree turnaround. And so he vies for the schools to be open. He vies for no one to have to wear a mask. All this silly stuff. You know, it's just, and some, it's going to be some people that's going to follow. You know, he could probably gun 10, 12 people down right in front of them, and they continue to follow him, don't see no wrong. So that's how crazy it's gotten. We don't need a leader like that. You know, he ain't my leader. I know that. If I got better sense. I've been listening to the things that man has been saying since before he got in office. There's some really wicked stuff dividing this country. You can't bring people together with hatred, you know. So I'm just real proud of all the people that stand up, you know, for the rights of others, and the people who do wear a mask, even though they don't. We wear masks and we don't have the corona. We wouldn't want to give it to someone else or receive it from someone else, you know. And there are certain things we can do to kind of slow it down. And I wish people would abide by those rules, you know. It's not an option, really. I know young people who have come on up here to Vegas and went on to those casinos and hotels and went back home with the virus, you know. And you're right. Didn't put them in the hospital or nothing, but still, the girl that I'm speaking of, she lives in her mother's house. You could have put her mother in the hospital. Her mother's older. Wow. And they say live and let live. Wear that mask. Wear the mask. Probably gloves, too. Wash your hands. All that. You know, until we get a grip on this thing. Other countries are following what the law is saying and wearing their mask and slowing it down. We're just beating it up here in the United States. So, I don't know, it's a sad situation. It is. So,
well, you know, you may, I don't cut you off. Did you want to continue?
No.
Well, I just wanted to mention something when you were mentioning about Jim Jones. You know, I knew Jim Jones, and
no.
I will never forget. Yeah, I did. But I will never forget when he first started his crusade to get converts up in the San Francisco Bay Area, because I think he first started off down near Fresno, and then he was able to get a lease on this this church that was not being used. It had a nice size capacity, probably could hold about 700 people. And it was right next to where the Nation of Islam mosque was. You know, we wanted to get that place, but it was a little bit out of our range in terms of being able to come up with the money. So we got a place that we renovated that was next to this large church. It was all really
wow.
All like connected together, it seemed like. Anyway, yeah, what's that? Okay, Jackie just showed me that the death count is up to 186,000. So it's definitely exponentially increasing. But anyway, to get back to what I was saying, so I was actually in the insurance, life insurance business at that time, and so I collected at people's houses, and so I had this one family. There were two sisters, I think. Two sisters lived together, and then the third sister lived across the street. The third sister died during the time that I was actually on that debit, on that route, but I knew her when she was alive before, you know, she got sick and she passed. And so the two sisters lived together. They were very nice women. They were, you know, grandmotherly age type people in their like 60s, late 50s. And mm-hmm. I remember going over to one lady's house, and she told me that she was going to be going out of town for the weekend. She was going down to San Francisco, because I was actually about 45 miles outside of San Francisco. And she said that she and some of her people, you know, they had decided to get associated with Jim Jones. They were all so excited. Yeah. So excited. Like Jim Jones was the Jesus Christ in their life that had come back in the flesh, right? And they were just like so excited. And I always wondered. I never did go back out there to talk to anybody in that neighborhood after that debacle, that suicide in Guyana down there. But I always wondered if she went down there with those people. I always wondered, you know, if she was one of those people that went down there to drink the Kool-Aid. But
mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that some people have that kind of power. You mentioned Hitler. He had that kind of power. You know, George Wallace, during his time, when he was the governor down in Alabama before he got shot, you know, he had that mesmerizing power over those, what they call crackers, those Georgia rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Alabama down there. And it seems like that this,
you know,
Donald
Quakers,
Trump.
Right? Exactly. And people follow them with their eyes wide shut.
Yeah. The thing is that I'm wondering if coming, you know, into this last few weeks of the election cycle, I'm wondering if enough people do have their eyes open, even if not wide open, at least open enough to be able to realize that this freedom, what they call American way of life, that America has praised itself for ever since 1776. If it's at the premise, the precipice of being crashed to the ground, never to rise again, because it looks like so many people are willing to let this country fall into the same kind of situation that happened in Nazi Germany back in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
They saw it coming, but you used the term aptly, but their eyes were wide shut. They saw it, but they didn't want to pay no attention to it. You know, and some of the people that suffered the most horrifically were some of the people that kept saying, don't worry about it, it's going to go away. We've been through this before. It ain't all that bad. It could be worse. And it did get worse, but they just kept, like sheep being led to the slaughter, just kept closing their eyes
right.
to the reality.
Exactly.
You know, that there was a plan that they didn't want to face up to destroy them. And I believe that there's a plan to destroy not only the brown and black people, but even the poor white people. And these are the ones that worship him.
A lot of people open their eyes to him, a lot of his own followers, because we do have brains, and they're seeing what's been going on, and they see what comes out of his mouth. And even though they were his follower, they said, no, that's not right. And they turn away from that. But there's some people, there's nothing you can do to convince them. They're like, just like you said, sheep being led to slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I want to just add this before we wrap up, because we're going to wrap up in a few minutes, because just you and me talking right now. There are others, I'm sure, that are listening. I wish they would call in and spend the last 20 minutes joining the conversation. So those of you who are listening, if you'd like to join this conversation, please call 657-383-0671. It's 657-383-0671. But I wanted to mention this, and that is the fact that in studying history and studying the history of dictators, you know, dictators always make a lot of promises they know they're not going to keep to get people to give up their freedom willingly. And it's a lot easier when you can get the people just to say, I surrender my freedom. You're going to be my idol. You're going to be my idol God. You're going to be the Baal up there on the altar of deceit, and I will follow you. And they like that. You know, they don't want to expend any more real effort in filling the people's tables with food or giving the people a comfortable house to live in. Then they absolutely have to. They want to share all the goodies with their friends that they need to keep propping them up. But the regular masses of people, they want to suck them into this big deceit. But I was going to say that I like studying people, prominent people. Like I studied Ronald Reagan. I had my odds with Ronald Reagan at one point in time.
Yeah,
as I've told,
I remember Reaganomics.
Yeah, Reaganomics. You see, I had a benefit that came out of Ronald Reagan because he was very pro-military, and I was just getting my career started in the Navy and was making a lot of money at that time. But he gave us a $200 raise, $200 month raise in one fell swoop. And so my attitude about him changed just because I benefited, Jack, and I benefited personally from that. But in general, you know, I found out that he was, like many of these leaders, you know, he was a white supremacist. And he attacked the black students when I was a student at the University of California, Berkeley, with the state police, and even using attack helicopter, well, I won't call them attack helicopter, helicopters. It wasn't like the Vietnam attack helicopters, but he used the helicopters to drop tear gas bombs down on the students that were protesting in favor of wanting to have a black studies program. So what I'm actually saying is that, but he was a different kind of white racist. Most of these white racists, they are white racists, and I don't forgive them for that, but they do have some class, they do have some degree of decency in spite of the evil side that they have. But, you know, this Trump, he's put out all the stops. See, he doesn't care what people say about him. It hurts him, but he gets the thrill out of being able to pay them back. In other words, bring it on. I know that I don't like to hit, but I do like to have a fight, so bring it on so I can get you. He gets the thrill out. That's the way he's always been. Ever since he was a little boy, I read about when he was a little boy, he used to do that. It's all been talked about by his niece and his own sister. But let me just say this before I close. I can't remember exactly when, Stephanie, it was. It was probably in the 90s when he first came to my attention. He came out with this book called The Art of the Deal. The guy who was the co-author who really, you know, did the literary writing of the book later in the last couple of years, he's been on talk show talking about it was all a bunch of lies, that Trump actually paid him big money to write a bunch of lies, that all of that success that Trump talked about, it was really just a cover up for a lot of business failures. But I remember when he had those, I think he had three casinos, if I'm not mistaken, in New Jersey. I don't know if they were all in Atlantic City, but they all failed. And he left those people who invested money in the casinos holding the bag. And when people, like the employees or people that he owed money to, complained about him basically taking them for a ride, he retaliated against them. Now, I don't know how connected he is with the mafia, but I do honestly believe that you cannot be involved in the gambling casino business without being connected with the mafia, even if you're an Indian tribe. The mafia is not going to let you run any kind of business like that, the praise off of people's weaknesses, if they're not getting a piece of the action. That's been their history and ever since they came over here. So that tells me, you know, we don't hear anything about it. I've heard no mafioso informers or anybody like Michael Cohen, any of those people that probably would know about some of the shady associates that he has. But I would not doubt that he has some very, very closely held secret relationships with some very serious strong men in the Cosa Nostra, the Mafia, the Black Hand, whatever you want to call it. And I think you're going to see more and more of that coming out. If this man gets, and God forbid, if he gets another term of office, you're going to see people getting snatched. I'm not talking about by people driving up in police cars and black vans, you know, with police. You're going to see people getting snatched up out of their houses in the middle of the night and taking place that you don't know where they went. And probably it's even happening already. But because he wants to be like his friend, I would say something else, but I don't want to say it over the air because he is president of the United States. But he wants to be like his friend, Vladimir Putin.
You know, exactly. That's
his hero. And see, Putin does that stuff, but he's able to get away with it because
he pulled himself out of his own mouth that he wished he could run this country like Putin runs Korea.
He said
on the news out of his own mouth. And you know they are afraid of Putin over there. They praise him. Their national anthem is about him. And I heard that instead of praying to God, they pray to him. The same thing against him to be killed. They're just petrified of him. And that's how Trump said he wants to run this country.
That's how he wants to run.
Like Putin ran his career.
Exactly.
So,
well, it's actually Kim in Korea and Putin in Russia, but they both cut from the same cloth. But Putin and Kim, they are the role models. That's exactly who Donald Trump wants to emulate. He wants to get the American people to roll over for that. Well, I'm not going to roll over for it. There's no way I'd roll over for it. But, that, you know, sadly, as we get ready to close, I see black people who are gullible enough to be rolling over for it. I mean, not
I'd
too
like
many.
I'd like to say something else.
Yeah,
can I speak on something before we close? See,
take all the time.
I've never been a racist person. Now, long time ago when I was young, in my younger years, I worked in a kitchen as a baker. And so we had to be there very early. And there was a white female that worked alongside of me. Every day when I got to work, I would say, good morning, and she wouldn't say anything. So one day I came in and I said, good morning to her, and someone else that worked there noticed. And they said, girl, you may as well save your breath. She ain't going to speak to nobody of color. Don't you see them lightning bolts on her arm? I said, what does that mean? I mean, she's white supremacist, KKK. I said, oh. They said, so that's why she never speaks back to you when you speak to her. So I said, when she and I was working side by side, how are you? And she didn't say anything. I said, it's okay. Somebody already told me you'll never speak to me. I said, but you know what? I'm going to not only speak to you, I'm going to pray for you because something awful, awful must have happened to you for you to display so much hatred towards someone that you don't even know. Because, you know, I don't know you from a hole in the ground. And so I don't understand where your anger and hatred comes towards me, just another human being on this earth. You know, but, and she said, you damn right you don't know what happened to me. I said, well, whatever it is, I'm going to pray about it, and I'm going to apologize for it. I don't know what black people and other people have done to you to have you display this type of reactions. She says, yeah, no one knows. And she said, but you know what? I like you. She says, now that doesn't mean that I'm going to speak to any other blacks, but I will talk to you because I like you. You're a good person. You know, kind of broke a barrier right there. Now, had I been a little bit younger than I was at that time, I probably would just knock the teeth out of her throat, down her throat for being that KKK. But, you know, I had gotten the Lord in my heart and was not leaning into my own understanding. You know, in another occasion, I had a neighbor. It's a white guy. And over the 2-3 years that he was my neighbor, you know, he's talked to me and stuff. And then one day, he started dropping tears. I said, Skip, what's going on? And he says, you know what, Stephanie, I used to be a skinhead, a racist, a white supremacist. He said, nobody on this earth could have ever told me that my best friend was going to be a black woman. I laughed, you know, but sometimes it's instilled in a person growing up. That's where that hatred comes from inside their household and what the community they surround themselves with. So, you know, it's just been horrible because it's been too much of it. But can you hear me?
Yes, just a minute, Stephanie. Hold on. I hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to say and remind everyone before we go to those voting polls. Now, I know people say, you can't listen to the media, stuff like that. I'm not going to remind anyone of anything that I heard on the media. This is out of your president's mouth. You know, when they asked him, what does he feel about all these black guys getting killed by these police? He said the only thing that the black community needs is more police. And the other day, in his inauguration, he was applauding the police, and he says they need to keep doing what they're doing. He's really bold in the things that he's saying. Okay, when Kaepernick took a knee because he's tired of black people getting a raw deal and not being treated equal, that's all that was about. We just want to be equal, you know, instead of people having their foot on our neck, we can't rise up and anything, you know. He called Kaepernick a son of a bitch who needs to get out of this country. But when all those KKK was marching, he referred to them as the good old boys. It's just been too many clues. He hasn't even tried to hide it. You know, his own son was speaking recently on television, and his son said, I'm so proud of my dad. My dad gave him hell for 4 years, and I hope he gets to be president again so that he can give him another 4 years of hell. Who is them? You know? And God. This goes on and on. The things that he said, and it's like the biggest clue slapped in the face. You can't miss it. So, you know, I know there was a saying, I hope you don't dislike me because of who I voted for. And the answer was, no, I don't. But I hope that you didn't vote for that person because you dislike me. Because how can you, if you're my friend, or even just in human nature, vote for someone who's that cruel to certain races of people? You know, and give them Puerto Ricans no help. Over there, Puerto Rico was tore down all those months with no electricity, nothing. And, you know, remember the children that were snatched, those Mexican children. Never did say what happened to them. Stopped all the foreign aid for all the countries that are black and brown and referred to them as shithole countries. You know, the only ones, you know, we're helping a lot of countries. Only ones we continue to help are white countries. Come on, you don't even have to be a rocket scientist to see how detrimental this man is into the United States. It's not right. He said the only ones that's going to get federal funding will be the ones who have Republican governors. That's about 6 states with Republican governors. We don't do stuff like that in the United States. All the states need federal funding, you know, and all that talk, collecting all that money for a wall and bought a $28 million yacht. That makes me think you might, if you lose, you might try to blow this country up and sell off in your yacht. $28 million, you know. He was saying he needed that much for the post office. Post office has been running since before he was born, any of us, you know. What, he took that money and got that yacht too? So I just want to remind everyone, when some people with their eyes wide shut want to pretend like they don't see anything wrong, But remember those things. Please remember those things when you go out and vote. It's not right. Thank you.
Stephanie, thank you so much. We've reached the top of the hour. The time has come. We have to say goodnight to our audience. We certainly thank you for the presentation that you made. It's very eloquent. It's definitely true. Everything you said is true, and it's something that everybody needs to take very, very seriously. And I'm not going to preach behind you, as we say in the church, let the preacher preach and let the deacon say amen. So
amen.
I'm going to be the say amen. So, no, I'm going to be the deacon, you the preacher. So tonight you've given a great sermon, which I appreciate that our audience was able to hear it. And I hope all of you that are out there listening take it to heart and definitely go vote your conscience, but let your conscience be your guide and let your conscience be for what is right. So with that, I'm going to close, and we're going to go ahead now and end with our beautiful song that is known throughout Black America as the Black National Anthem. And here we go. May God bless all of you, keep you, keep you safe, and hopefully we'll be together again on this show on next week.